This is WJBC This Week.
We live 10 minutes from the school, and we can't even get a return phone call. Seven phone calls.
These problems are unacceptable. We are addressing some key issues.
I've had to take a real close look at myself as being human and very fallible.
I think there are other people that are like me that still think there's a possibility that we can find a buyer.
The lines have been drawn to protect partisan advantage and incumbents.
Not having two stores certainly could be the difference in making or not making that goal.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, local officials aren't giving up hope that a buyer will emerge for the now-closed Mitsubishi Motors plant, even after a reported deal fell through. The Fair Map Amendment gets the boot. We'll hear from a leader of the citizen-led group. A critic for decriminalizing marijuana discusses the town of Normal's new policy for the drug. A local man shares his story of his brother gone missing in Vietnam as a Vietnam Memorial Tribute Wall comes to Bloomington. Plus, a new music instructor at Illinois Wesleyan, who has performed with some top celebrities, performs in Uptown Normal this weekend. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. There was optimism in some circles as the now-closed Mitsubishi Motors plant in Normal appeared close to finding a buyer. This week, the plant's owner, Maynard's Industries, announced the firm couldn't come to an agreement with Humvee maker AM General of Indiana to take over the plant. This as a mid-October auction of the plant and its equipment approaches. Normal City Manager Mark Peterson talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Would it seem like to you that we've hit the end of the road with believing that that's going to become another manufacturing plant?
Well, I don't know. Call me crazy, but I haven't given up yet. And I think there are other people that are like me that still think there's a possibility that we can find a buyer for that facility. I haven't given up on AM General. Frankly, I think there's still some possibility that that deal could be worked out. But by the same token, I haven't talked with those folks at all, so I don't know some of their issues. But I still think there's a possibility, and we're going to continue to work on it as a community to try to attract a buyer. And we may not be successful, but we're going to, you know, fight hard to the end. And again, if ultimately that plan is dismantled, that's not the end of the world either. We're going to have still a wonderful area out there that's got great services that could become maybe an industrial business park or something of that nature. We'd hate to see that happen. We'd hate to lose that beautiful asset. But if that happens, it's not the end of the world. But again, we're not going down without a fight. And I think there are a number of other people in the community that feel the same way I do.
Here's my wonderment question here today. You're talking about finding a buyer for this, but you don't own the building. So how does that work?
It's tricky.
Yeah, I wonder how that works.
Trying to sell a piece of property you don't own.
Yeah.
Well, I will say the folks at Maynard's who do own the property have been very cooperative, and they also would their preference is to find one buyer to take it all. They would rather not have to go through the process of parceling it out piece by piece. So they certainly are motivated as well, and they have been good partners up to this point, and I'm sure they will continue to be good partners. So we work closely with them. When I say we, I'm primarily talking about the Economic Development Council. I happen to be on their board of directors, and I talk regularly with Kyle Hamm and the folks at that agency, so I do interact with them a lot. But they've worked well with the EDC, and I think will continue to work well up until the end. So if we hadn't had that cooperative kind of relationship, it would be much more difficult. But at the end of the day, they want the same thing we want, and hopefully we'll get there.
There were all kinds of reports out last weekend and starting with Friday that I started to hear that, oh, the state is stepping up with incentives and you know, they're really working hard to get this. And then the state says, no, we didn't have anything to do with that. Can you kind of lay out the landscape of this whole process of how you went after the people at the Humvee?
Well, the state of Illinois, without question, has an interest in seeing this facility repurposed and reoccupied. from the governor's office all the way down to the staff at the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. They have been involved. They have been working on this diligently, as we have been locally. So I feel like everybody's pulling on the same rope in the same direction. The unions have been supportive out there, the UAW, the local business community. Our legislators throughout the region have been very supportive. So I think everybody's working together. We're really trying hard. I can't think of any stone that has not been unturned. I can't think of anything else we could have done as a community. I think we're doing everything we can, and hopefully something we'll catch a break along the way. We haven't yet. We haven't caught a break. I thought we had a few along the way, but unfortunately they didn't work out. So I'm still hoping that something works out. They're planning an auction sometime in October, Maynard's is, so I think we have at least until, you know, early October to try to make something happen, and we're going to keep pushing until we just have no more time.
I heard over the weekend, and we'll wrap it up with this, I heard over the weekend that this particular deal that was trying to be put together with the people at AM General over in South Bend, that it was people were excited here in the community. They said, well, it's going to happen. It may be by the end of this week. Did you get the sense that this was going to be the one that was going to happen? And then what the heck? Why did it fall apart?
I did. And I don't know all the details, frankly, Dan. I know a little bit, and I had a good feeling about it. I just felt that this was a perfect match, and it was going to happen. I don't know exactly what went wrong. I mean, I've heard stories secondhand, thirdhand, but I don't know. But ultimately, the people who made that decision apparently saw things differently than we did here, and maybe even saw things differently than some did within their own company. But again, I haven't completely given up hope on that opportunity, and there are others out there that I still think have possibilities. So, and sometimes even an announcement like this that occurred over the weekend, which kind of caught everyone by surprise, sometimes that in and of itself will, just the coverage of that will kind of flush another potential buyer out of the woodwork, and who knows who may call this week. So we'll keep pushing as we have been, and hopefully something good will happen.
That was Normal City Manager Mark Peterson with Dan Swaney. The Illinois Supreme Court this week struck down a citizen-led initiative to create a less politically driven process for drawing legislative maps. The effort was the second failed attempt by the Independent Map Amendment Group to put a proposal on the ballot. The group's director, Cindy Canary, talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Not a successful outcome. Can you tell me why you think that is?
Yes, we've been working on this for well over a year, year and a half, lots of good volunteers, particularly in Central Illinois. And we got 560,000 signatures. We got our signatures accepted by the State Board of Elections. And then we were sued by a group called the People's Map, who were represented by the speaker's attorney, Mike Casper, about the constitutional provision for getting onto the ballot. It's about the structure and procedure clause, a highly technical legal question. We lost in the circuit court, but we appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court, and yesterday evening at about 6 p.m., on a partisan basis, they upheld the lower court, which means that the people of Illinois are not going to get to vote on this very important question about redistricting.
I'm trying to understand and wrap my head around what was not constitutional about having this on the ballot.
Yeah, it's like legal theory 606 here, but in Illinois, you know, we don't work like California. We don't, and that's a good thing. You know, we don't decide everything by citizens' initiative. We've got one narrow clause in the legislative article that says the citizens can petition to change the structure and procedure of Illinois government. So that is what we did. That was the case that we made. Now, the court came back, and they didn't, they said essentially, well, you know, redistricting, that's probably structural and procedural. But because this is in the legislative article and you are going to the Auditor General and the court and asking other governmental actors to assist in setting up the structure for an independent commission, you've gone outside the bounds of the article. Our argument is, for goodness sakes, these are all related questions. The people who wrote our state constitution obviously didn't give citizens the ability to petition their government without giving them any way to enact change. And so this decision, in effect, kind of renders that initiative provision kind of meaningless. It's a head-scratching decision.
Why would Michael Madigan, and I'm assuming that he helped fund this this group that was against the independent map amendment, why would he be so forceful in trying to prevent voters from saying, okay, yeah, we like this, or yet, no, we don't?
Well, first of all, Michael Madigan says that he has not funded this, and we don't know that because the group that's against this hasn't filed any reports on contributions or expenditures, despite state law. So we simply don't know where their money's coming from. But why is he so against this? You know, I think that the whole issue with redistricting is it's a fundamental conflict of interest. You know, the lines have been drawn to protect partisan advantage and incumbents. And Madigan has done this really quite masterfully. The Republicans have done it as well, but no one's done it quite as well as the Speaker has. And although there is absolutely no guarantee in our crazy system that he will hold the pen again in 2020, apparently he's fairly confident, and it's a gamble he's willing to take. But I think depriving the people of a vote when 560,000 people signed a petition to say they wanted the chance to vote really shows a shocking lack of faith and trust in the citizenry of this state.
I'm just trying to figure out, you know, now that the court has said no, are we ever going to have the ability to go back and ask for this again? Or do we need to go directly to Michael Madigan and other supporters of the way things currently are, and for people that don't like the way things mm-hmm. are, say we don't like it?
Well, there are a couple of options, and you know, this just happened last night, so we're looking at all of the options. The first one is there is an ability to ask the Supreme Court to reconsider their decision. Now, that means, you know, you're going back to the same people and saying, oh, come on now.
Yeah.
So, who knows? But that's one thing. There certainly is, an ability to go after this again in 2018. It's a very time consuming and costly effort. And there is also, and I think this is really important because this may be, you know, something we should do regardless. You know, we need to go to our elected officials, many of whom, Democrats and Republicans, signed on as supporters to this initiative, and tell them that we want to see some action in the legislature. We want to see them advance a legislative initiative for independent redistricting. They've pledged that they support this, and now they should show it to us. The legislature doesn't have the same hurdles that citizens have in terms of putting something on the ballot. You know, it would change the Constitution, so it's still a ballot question. But I think that, you know, those legislators who said that they supported us, you know, it's time for them to put the rubber to the road.
Couldn't you do something non-binding where just the people's voice were heard? It didn't necessarily mean that things are going to change, but wouldn't that send a strong message to those that don't want to change?
I suppose that you could, but ultimately you would have to do something binding because we're talking about changing our Constitution. So, you know, whether the legislature puts this on the ballot or citizens put it on the ballot or we have another constitutional convention and change things, we have to take one of those routes to actually take redistricting out of the hands of the legislature. They can't just do it legislatively.
I was hoping that something would change on the federal level, and I know this just affected the statewide districts, but we've had several interviews, and I know that it could have been a catalyst for something to happen federally, because I live in one of those areas where my neighbors across the street vote for someone in the 18th congressional district, and I vote in the 13th congressional district. So it just that boggles my mind that a district could change based on where your mailbox is.
Yeah, it's, you know, our federal map, our representatives, it's crazy. You see these, that's where it really gets nuts. You see these tiny little strips, particularly in central Illinois, you know, just picking up bits of Springfield. yeah, literally, you cross the road and you're in a different district. You know, we have a problem in this country, and it's not owned by Democrats or Republicans. In this state, we have a very Democratic gerrymander. In other states like Texas, you see a very Republican gerrymander. And I think that the fundamental problem is that districts and representatives are supposed to represent the communities that elect them. And what we have now is a system that really doesn't represent the people who elect people. It really is about partisanship. It's about advancing majorities and protecting incumbents. And, you know, that both at the state level and federally has led us to nothing but roadblock politics.
That was Cindy Canary of the Independent Map Amendment with Terry James. The town of Normal recently adopted new rules regarding marijuana possession. The town has fines that are already stiffer than those set by the state, which has decriminalized the drug. Violators in Normal could see fines of up to $1,000 for 10 grams or less. Previously, those fines applied to only 2.5 grams or less. Town Councilman Jeff Fritzen, a critic of decriminalizing marijuana, talked to WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
One of the big issues we have now is with legalization in some states, legalization of medical marijuana, which, you know, the DEA last week said it's still a class one drug because there's no scientific evidence of a medical use for it, and there's a large possibility of abuse. And so they kept it classified the way they did. They caught some flack for that, but, you know, it's true.
Well, you can say that about Oxycontin.
Well, yeah, but that's, you know, part of we could be on here for an hour, but
we've got an hour.
Yeah, an article in the Wall Street Journal last week was an excerpt from an article. It was an Esquire said, you know, the rise in the use of heroin can be attributed somewhat to the legalization of marijuana. Now, why is that? It's because those who were providing the marijuana lost a market. The cartels that were pushing the marijuana lost a market. They had to replace it with a different product. So they replaced it with this heroin, which is obviously tied to these painkillers and everything else and people getting hooked. So part of the heroin problem in the country is because of the legalization of marijuana. It's an unintended circumstance, you know, result. But, you know, these are the things that happen. And to me, the higher fines, you know, civil fines are not a moneymaker. I've caught in a little flack. I've gotten a couple of off-color phone calls and emails that are I consider very inappropriate and disrespectful, but it goes with the territory. But anyway, civil fines are not a huge source of revenue for the cities. They're just not. You know, in multi-million dollar budgets, what we collect in civil fines is not a big revenue issue. Civil fines are to serve as a deterrent. You know, if you're speeding and you're caught speeding, the next time you're going through that area of town, you're going to think twice about it. You're going to slow down. That's the purpose of that civil fine. Same thing here. It's to serve as a deterrent, not a moneymaker. And the state statute, even though it relaxes things and expunges that criminal record that used to be attached with these things, the first statement still says that the possession of cannabis is illegal, and you know, so you're participating in illegal activity. Mm-hmm. And the street value of up to, you know, about 10 grams of marijuana is in that $180 to $200 range. So if you can afford to go out and spend $200 on an illegal substance and you get caught with it, why should the fine be the same or less than what the cost of that is. To me, the higher fine makes all the sense in the world.
So, well, yeah, and I'll argue that with you because I said something. I think one community, I can't remember who it was, they increased their fine for cigarettes or possession of cigarettes from a minor to where it was, I think maybe it was Chicago. It would cost you more if you were caught with cigarettes than it would if you were caught with a joint, which made no sense to me at all. So, but you're talking $350 to $1,000. That's a big spread when the state's going $100 to $200. So what's the difference? What differentiates a $350,000 or $350 fine and a $1,000 fine? Is it the amount?
It may be the amount. It may be the circumstances. It's a subjective thing. And, you know, at this point,
it's subjective.
Well, it is, but that's why there's a range. You know, I mean, and we don't as a council, we don't get exposed to the imposition of those fines. You know, they've been a criminal thing in the past, so it's left up to a judge to kind of decide based on the circumstances what they're going to do. Now it'll be up to, you know, our legal department, and not sure how they'll go about that. But especially when there's no ongoing record of things, you know, with a liquor violation by one of our license holders, you know, first offense is a certain dollar amount, second offense is another dollar amount, the third offense is another dollar amount, and a suspension. You know, we have something in place. So this will be something that our legal department probably feel their way along and see how it happens. But, I don't know that there are even a huge number of these types of violations. So the legalization, the diminishment of the relaxation of the laws and whatever, you know, that's a message that people hear, and young people in particular, but people hear and think this is an okay activity. And like I said, it's still illegal. And then the thing that being parents is concerned about is the THC levels in marijuana are not your parents' or grandparents' marijuana anymore. The THC levels are highly concentrated, and marijuana is not just the little bag of weed that, you know, people roll up and smoke. It comes in concentrated forms where the THC level is off the wall, and it's a lot more addictive these days than it was in the past. And it is a gateway drug, and there is a huge increase in the country and young people in particular who have a greater chance of becoming addicted to something like this, where they are having to seek treatment. So it's a big issue in our society.
It's going to kill you. The college kids that are token up, they're going to go to Bloomington where the fine is $100 to $200, and then they're going to get the munchies and eat at their restaurants. And then you guys are going to lose out on all that revenue.
Well, there's some who would complain about our sending our students to Bloomington for those kinds of activities, but those are personal choices.
You're
They're
okay
not things that we're involved with.
That was Normal Town Councilman Jeff Fritzen with Scott Laughlin. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A nearly full-size replica of the Vietnam Memorial Wall was delivered to Evergreen Memorial Cemetery in Bloomington for display this weekend. WJBC's Dan Swaney broadcast live from the cemetery this week. One of the more than 53,000 names on that wall belonged to the brother of Rick Scott of Normal. David Scott went missing in Vietnam after his group, the 5th Battalion, 7th Cavalry, came under attack on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in April of 1968, just after David turned 21. Rick Scott shared his brother's story on WJBC This Week.
I was a freshman in high school, and I can remember, like it was yesterday, getting the note in study hall in the lunchroom at Normal Community to come to the office, and my dad was there to pick me up and get me home. And then the next big event was in July. For statistical reasons, I guess. I don't know why. I guess through their investigation more than anything, they changed the status from missing in action to missing in action, presumed killed, body not recovered. And then, unfortunately, for whatever reason, I lived with that not knowing that he was killed. All I ever heard as a 15-year-old, my parents trying to protect me, was that he was missing in action. So all these thoughts go through your head for years. And then in, I don't know the exact year, I wished I would have kept a journal, about 1988, about the time we had the Welcome Home Parade, I had put a ad in the Sabre News, which is the newspaper that the First Cav guys subscribe to, the veterans, and looking for anybody that had served my brother, because I was just curious. Wanted some answers to some questions. And I got a phone call at night from this Mike Sprayberry. And since then, I've been in touch with him. I've probably had 60 phone calls with him over the years and emails back and forth, and we've met, and I've gone to the reunions a couple times. They just had another reunion that I didn't go to in Colorado Springs, but they treat me like one of their own now.
I bet.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat deal. But,
How did the family cope with it? Because that, when a loved one is in a gray area where you don't know for sure, you don't have a physical body to bury, how did the family deal with that? You hear these stories, but I've never met anybody who actually had to go through it.
Well, I can only speak for myself and my observations, but it really hurt my parents deeply, of course. Changed my father. He was a railroad man, worked in the yards at the railroad, GM&O Railroad, and he would come home in the afternoon, 3:30, 4 o'clock, set his lunchbox down, say hello, and go out to the garage and work in the garage until supper time, come in, eat supper, go back out to the garage. He pretty much limited his contact with us from there on, and then he died a young man. He was only 56 when he died of a heart attack. My mother, constantly in grief about it, constantly, I didn't know at the time because I was 15 years old, but numerous letters back and forth to D.C. trying to get questions answered and stuff like that. I think it was she didn't want to admit that he was gone. And she never told us that he was actually killed. It just, the story we were told as a 15-year-old anyway was four or five of the guys were missing at the same time.
The story we told.
So for years I went until I talked to this Sprayberry on the phone, went with the thought that, you know, maybe he's a POW. And then you watch the POWs come home off the plane. He's not with them. And so anyway, it progressed through that. And then after my mother passed away, I got all kinds of records, my brother's records and stuff, and I found out, you know, he was actually gone that day. The military knew he was killed. I guess she just didn't want to accept it or didn't want to tell us. There was never a funeral service. When my father passed away, my mother did buy a headstone, so there is a headstone but no remains at the cemetery, at East Lawn Cemetery. And so now I kind of deal with it, I guess, from going to the reunions and kind of feeling like maybe I'm standing in for him.
You know? I'm guessing it, even though it's been close to 50 years now,
It
doesn't seem like that amount of time has passed since it's always with you.
No, it seems like it was 2 years ago. No closure, you know.
Yeah.
Terry, earlier on your program, was talking about the wall and how he's impacted by the wall. And the thing that, for whatever reason, I spoke to you off the air, the wall, when I saw it for the first time in D.C., did not affect me emotionally. Didn't bother me at all. But for some reason, when the first time the wall came here to the Twin Cities, it was out at Country Companies on Towanda Avenue. Three separate times I tried to go on the grounds and had to leave. I couldn't stay. It affected me so much. It's really something dramatic to see. And I remember when I first saw the wall, or first heard of the concept before it was even built, I thought it was a strange concept not to have them in alphabetical order. So that you could find them. I thought that was really odd, and I thought the shape of the wall was really odd. But now that I'm familiar with it and saw what they did, it's remarkable, because you can stand back and you can see how the war began with very few casualties. The casualties progressed as the war went on, peaked, and then trails off.
Yeah.
And it's really a neat idea the way they did it.
That was Rick Scott of the American Veterans Traveling Tribute Memorial Wall in Bloomington with Dan Swaney. Illinois Wesleyan's new jazz director has played with some real A-listers in the entertainment industry, and he's playing this weekend in Normal. The Saturday performance meant as a tribute to the late composer Thomas Chapin ahead of the Normal Theater showing of the documentary Thomas Chapin Nightbird Song. Glenn Wilson talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
How does that work in the world of education? Do they call you and start sniffing around saying, hey, we'd like you to do this?
Well, it just so happened that I knew the person that was there, Tim Pitchford, who was there for the last 5 years. Another really excellent trombonist. And Tom Streeter, who started the program there, was there 37 years. He was a trombonist. So they wanted to hire another trombonist slash jazz person, but they decided that they would break it up into two jobs. So I'm going to be teaching saxophone and doing the jazz ensemble, and then someone else will be teaching the trombone. So it was word of mouth, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But
and it saves you a commute because this is your home backyard.
Right.
And then a salute also, because if you don't mention your wife on the radio, you get in trouble when you get back home, who's a fine performing arts teacher over at Illinois State
She's
University.
She's the director of the School of Theater and Dance at ISU. Yep.
So when you go to her performances, are you required to wear red and vice versa with
yes,
green?
Yes, I have red and green. I'm getting some green. I have
You've had a lot of blue.
I have a lot of red and orange. I have a lot of orange, which I can't wear now. So,
just silliness. You're traveling around and performing with Trombari.
Yeah,
and
I have several different groups actually, and I do a lot of freelancing. I played this summer with Seth MacFarlane up at Ravinia.
Shut the front door! I love Seth MacFarlane.
Last year, I played with Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett up there. And
okay,
you know.
Now we need to talk, sir. How does that application process happen, and where can I apply?
Oh well, I have a lot of friends in Chicago that know me, so they call me for things, and I just
you're the guy.
I
you're
freelance. I do some touring and traveling, although I'll be doing a lot less now that I'm teaching full time. So
I'm sorry. Just Ravinia is called. Tony Bennett needs an extra baritone sax. Are you open?
Yeah.
Do they love you more because you can play baritone sax and flute, or is it all about the bari sax?
It's
or
all
that
about
guy?
The bari sax. Yeah, I'm that guy.
Because that's
a
very competitive instrument.
Well, there aren't that many players, but there aren't that many gigs either, so it all works out.
Okay. Adam Fox, I know you're being very quiet and respectful over there from the Normal Theater, but I am in awe right now of this man.
I understand, and I'm always lurking in the corner of the studio. You know, more often than not, I'm over here quiet in the corner, so don't worry about me.
So I don't know between the two of you who to give credit for the idea of what's happening Saturday night at the Normal Theater, which is the fact that Thomas Chapin's life and whole existence is immortalized in film with the Thomas Chapin Night Bird Song movie.
Yeah.
And the movie is going to be shown Saturday night, 7 mm-hmm. o'clock at the Normal Theater. But that's not all you're going to see Saturday night.
Right.
Mr. Wilson, tell us more.
Well, we recorded a CD of Thomas's music. It was actually a CD that he did called Haywire that we sort of did the whole CD with our group back in 2012. And, you know, Tom was a great friend of mine. We played in the Lionel Hampton Orchestra together for years in New York, and we were neighbors in New York. And I didn't know this record at all, Haywire, and I bought a box set of his CDs that his widow wife put out, and Haywire was one of them. And I thought, oh, wow, this is fantastic music. And I also knew a really excellent violinist and cello player. This music has violin, cello, trombone, baritone sax, two basses, and a drummer and a percussionist. So it was very unique.
Both stand-up double basses?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, on the
wow.
record. We're only going to use one on the concert. But
okay.
But there's two on the record.
I don't think I've ever seen that before.
I know. It's really unusual and a pain in the neck to get around.
You know? Darn it, we need another trailer.
Yeah, right. But anyway, so I really love the music. So I contacted Terry and I said, did you have any copies of this? And of course she sent me the PDFs that Tom had done, because Tom was an entrepreneur way ahead of his time. When my first record came out in 1985, recorded in 84, Tom was there in the studio, and his first record was recorded about a month after mine, so I was in the studio for him. We sort of helped each other produce. And you know, the record hadn't even come out yet when he showed up at my door with a little stamp that said Impasse Glenn Wilson, and you could stamp your thing. And then he made me a cassette thing at the time where mm-hmm. you did your own cassettes, and he made me a cassette label with all the tunes on it, done on his dot matrix printer and a picture of me and everything, and just showed up at my door and said, here you go, start promoting your CD, your LP at the uh-huh. time, or cassette, you know. So I knew that he would have some of this music if it was at all possible, and of course he did. So we rearranged it for our group and recorded it in 2012. So when I heard, when the movie came out, which was just this past spring, they've been working on this movie for a couple of years. It started with a Kickstarter campaign and went from there. And
did they ask for your input on the movie? Did they realize how well you knew him?
Yeah, they did. And I was interviewed over the phone a few times. I never could make the live interviews. I was hoping to be interviewed in the movie. But my name's in there a few times, and they show our album cover in there and some other stuff like that. But, when I heard that they were making a movie, I was very interested in that. And then it debuted this spring at the Cannes Film Festival, and it won Best Story at the Nice Film Festival. And it, they've had a showing in New York and Connecticut, but this is really only the, quite a handful of showings they've had so far. So this will be one of the Midwest premiere, certainly, and one of the first six or eight showings of the movie. And it's really an excellent movie, I think. It's a great movie, and it's interesting because Tom was such an interesting person. But as a jazz musician, of course, I find it very compelling. And when someone passes away too soon, Tom passed away in 1998 at the age of 40 from leukemia, got sick and was gone pretty quickly. And when someone, an artist especially, passes away young, you wonder what else they might have contributed. What else did they have to say?
That was Illinois Wesleyan jazz director Glenn Wilson with Susan Saunders. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Unit 5's school board heard from many upset parents this week at their meeting at Normal West High School. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reported many district buses had been overcrowded and or late in the first week of school.
Jonathan Amaya says his four-year-old special needs student has almost an hour and a half bus ride.
He can't even speak for himself, and we live 10 minutes from the school.
Really?
And we can't even get a return phone call. Seven phone calls.
Superintendent Mark Daniel took time to apologize to parents.
These problems are unacceptable. We are addressing some key issues, and we want those to be timely, and we want those to be immediate.
Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner officially announced his bid for a second term this week.
Thank you all for coming out.
Renner stood before dozens of supporters in front of the Route 66 Visitor Center and acknowledged his sometimes brash style, something he says he's trying to soften a bit.
Unless you're a real narcissist, you got to pretty quickly can constantly take a look at yourself in the mirror and say, okay, I did some bad things. I shouldn't have done this. How do I improve myself as a human being? I've had to take a real close look at myself as being human and very fallible.
Renner says he's fulfilled his campaign promises to make City Hall more transparent, improve the city's infrastructure, and help grow the local economy. In a move that could change Illinois election law, Dr. David Gill of Bloomington is being allowed to run for Congress as an independent in the 13th Congressional District. A federal court judge in Springfield ruled that even though Gill did not collect nearly the 11,000 valid signatures needed, he can still be on the ballot.
That wasn't frivolous what myself and my associates did for 90 days between March and June. To collect 8,600 signatures was a tremendous effort.
Gill argued the number of signatures he was forced to collect far exceeded what Republican incumbent Rodney Davis and Democratic challenger Mark Wicklund had to collect. The lawsuit was filed against the State Board of Elections, which sets the rule on the number of signatures required. The grocery that has branded itself the friendliest store in town is banning charities from seeking donations outside its doors. Schnucks has announced a new policy at all 99 of its stores, including the two in Bloomington Normal, which bans all solicitors from its property. The St. Louis-based company says in a statement, quote, "Our primary obligation is servicing our customers by providing the most pleasant and convenient shopping environment. Groups such as the Salvation Army will have to come up with other ways to raise the money."
Typically, on our kettle goal, we either just reach it or barely reach it or just exceed it a little bit. So, I mean, that not having two stores certainly could be the difference in making or not making that goal.
Angie Fulton with the Salvation Army of Bloomington says the charity has close to two dozen sites in the Twin Cities that collect donations each year. Governor Rauner signed a bill that will save local paramedics thousands of dollars when treating those who are having allergic reactions. State Senator Chapin Rose says the same medication in the expensive EpiPen can be delivered through a syringe for pennies on the dollar.
We could get it for $50 if we could just dispense this out of a vial. Like, what? $24 versus $50, okay? That's crazy.
Rose criticized EpiPen maker Mylan, saying they're pricing themselves out of the business. And Congressman Darren LaHood says makers of the EpiPen, Mylan, need to explain why they've dramatically increased the price in recent years. And if they don't, LaHood says Congress should get involved.
We have to look at all avenues, but if you're prohibiting young children and people that are sick or people that have allergies from getting the medicine they deserve, there's a role for government to play in making sure that there's an even playing field.
LaHood tells WJBC's Scott Laughlin he wouldn't advocate government price setting, but he says deterring people from buying life-saving medication by increasing the price 400% in 5 years is wrong. And the McLean County Chamber of Commerce held a forum this week to discuss immigration reform and its impact on business. Chamber President Charlie Moore says significant issues regarding immigration law are prohibiting employers from retaining workers. He points to agriculture as a specific example.
If you have folks that are working on a farm and they aren't able to stay, it doesn't allow those farmers to retain, especially in their interim, so whether they're seasonal employees, to be able to stay, or if they're all-year annual employees.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Tuesday, former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen is scheduled to appear in federal court in Chicago on wire fraud charges. The judge in the case has said he'll set a trial date at that hearing unless the charges are resolved. On Thursday, Uptown Normal will host its annual Light the Night Bike Light Giveaway. Also Thursday, WJBC will host its first Brock Spack Show of the season, live from the Scooters Beer Garden at 6 o'clock. And on Saturday, Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan will kick off the football season with home games. The Redbirds will take on Valparaiso. The Titans will play a college team from Mexico. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stark.